This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to the August 1st, 2022 For Your Benefit radio show. Today we have Dave DeJong and Steve Woodis, tax and estate attorneys with the firm Stein, Sperling, Bennett, DeJong, and Driscoll. So we're going to talk about various topics, but the initial focus will be tax effect and timing of the transaction. We're going to talk about nuptial agreements, revisions to the estate plan, and many other things. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I know that there won't be a millisecond of time wasted, but if we were to start off, we're going to go into the marriage category and then talk about divorce after that. Is that okay?
That's right. Sure. Sounds good.
Okay. So, you know, with me being kind of a tax guy, so my question would be, will a couple pay more or less taxes if they get married?
Well, that depends, Bob, on their individual situations. But in most cases, they will pay more taxes if they are married, particularly if the two of them each have healthy incomes. About the only exceptions would be if one of the two had little or no income, was a stay-at-home spouse, and then you could have some very rare circumstances where one has very high medical expenses and low income, or has a capital loss carry forward that could give you a quirky result. But in general, you will pay more by being married unless one of the couple has little or no income.
Interesting. Just a thought process as you were talking. What if the couple is married, but they don't live together? They live in different states. Does that become a kind of a quagmire?
Well, the question is, are they, do they have a legal separation? That's very rare these days. In general, you are married until you have a decree of final divorce. There is a special rule allowing a spouse who is caring for the children to file head of household prior to a divorce. But a couple who's living apart without a legal separation, that's more than a separation agreement, without a legal separation or a divorce, is married.
So in both of your experience, do sometimes, clearly they're represented by different attorneys, maybe not in all cases, but I would say 99%.
Well, they should be in a divorce. Yeah. One attorney cannot ethically represent both parties in a divorce, even if the parties have an agreement in principle prior to it being documented. It certainly can be inexpensive if the parties have a prior meeting of the minds, but each should have separate counsel.
Now, I would imagine that probably some want to come in and say, no, everything's fine, but you're right. Everything can't be fine because what they thought may have been fine maybe has some rough edges.
Yeah. And that's the same for a prenuptial agreement. Each should have a separate attorney.
So to that extent, I agree with Dave. But Bob, one of the reasons on both the divorce and the prenuptial agreement, which we should address as well, is the fact that for each to be upheld, you don't want anybody to ever go into court and say, gee, I had no idea what I was giving up, whether it be through a divorce or a prenuptial agreement. The courts normally want each party to be represented by separate counsel. So there's not a feeling that somebody was sort of going into the arrangement a little bit naked, that they at least understood what there was and that they had representation. Now, prenuptial agreements, by the way, have become extremely a lot more popular, I'd say, over time, whether it's people getting married later, second marriages, whatever. And the prenuptial agreement for basically situations that Dave will cover in a minute, really, whether it's from the family or the individuals, has become more popular with people getting married a little bit later, as I say, second marriages, people with children. But normally, we refer to the fact that sort of the rich spouse, poor spouse. But the prenuptial agreement assumes it's going to be signed well in advance of the marriage. And unlike a lot of the movies, it should not be signed the night before or as they're walking up to the altar to be signed. And again, it should be represented. They have certain pieces that they've got to have full disclosure for assets, liabilities, and all that. But normally, it's the wealthy spouse that typically the future spouse that needs the would normally want this to protect it, whether it could be for a future divorce or death. And those are very different situations that I think Dave might cover. But again, there, and a lot of times, by the way, many people have found that their families are sort of insisting on it, whether it's the rich spouse said, I want this money preserved for our future grandchildren. They don't want the evil, future in-law to get some of that, some of that money.
The closer you get to the wedding date, the more stress completing the prenuptial agreement is going to exist. About 10 or 12 years ago, I was assisting the bride-to-be in a prenuptial agreement, and it was literally signed about midnight, the night before they were going to get married.
Whoa.
And I was a friend of both, although I represented the bride-to-be. And I had to do the toast at their wedding about 18 hours after their
Wow.
prenup
Now,
was signed.
how'd you pull that one off?
Not easily.
Well, and it does put a lot of pressure on a marriage. We often joke that let's get this legally binding arrangement taken care of, and then hopefully you put it in a drawer that's there and everybody knows where it is, but at least it's not sitting out on the wall, next to the marriage certificate. So,
What is
but
interesting is as we see more marriages across ethnic and cultural lines, is we learn that in certain backgrounds, prenuptial agreements are not looked at favorably, and that has caused issues in several cases where I've represented the individual who absolutely wanted a prenuptial agreement.
So,
And in the background, one other comment, Bob, is that remember the courts aren't really crazy about prenuptial agreements. The sort of thinking is one of the aspects of listing out all the assets, making sure everybody's got separate counsel, everybody's had a chance to review the last couple of years of income tax returns, is they don't want somebody to go in there blindly. I guess the old expression, walking into a dark closet, with your open wallet, is that they want to make sure that people are aware of what's going on. And so these need to be pretty tight. And as Dave said, having them agreed to well in advance makes it look a lot better than that, 18 hours before the wedding.
Are there common, commonly arrived at things that are not dealt with in a prenuptial? Not that you would have anything to do with that, but do you see prenuptial agreements and you go, why didn't they include this? Is there some commonality to that?
Well, let me start with that question because I think it's a very important one, and then Dave may add on. I think I'd like to start with what normally is handled with the prenuptial. Normally, the rules for a marriage split up, whether it be divorce, legal separation, whatever, versus death, are covered, but normally very separately. The rules are very different, and people are very confused by that. Because the old rule that once you walk into a marriage, you can walk back out with is really not true in the death situation. And we can get into that a little bit more. But the general rule that one aspect of a prenuptial agreement should not cover children and future children. They, by law, you can't essentially legislate what you're going to give a child or not. Maybe you can do that and talk about trust, but you can't really bind children. The law... The judges aren't crazy about people trying to determine how much in advance one spouse is going to be responsible for as opposed to the other.
Okay, so in a little bit of the reverse of that, are there any issues that cannot be dealt with in a prenuptial that somebody thought should be?
Well, I think Steve alluded to it, that the one issue that cannot be dealt with in a prenuptial agreement is anything related to the welfare of a child of the marriage. And that would be items related to custody and the amount of support. Now, where I'm representing the husband, who is typically the non-custodial parent, I will put in a prenuptial agreement going into the marriage that the parties agree that each of them possesses fine parenting skills, and it is their intention that irrespective of the marriage that that each will share time with any child of the marriage, or words to that effect. I don't know the extent to which that helps down the road if the marriage doesn't work out, but that is the only thing related to a child that I ever put in an agreement, and that's where I'm representing the likely non-custodial parent.
And one other aspect that tangentially impacts that is that when we're talking about this two-part agreement, saying what happens if the marriage splits up and what happens on the death of one of the spouses while the parties are still married, if you think about it and you determine that in the event of the marital split up, that a spouse is going to receive certain amount of alimony or certain amount of property division. And those are two separate aspects also. You know, what assets are physically going to go to between the spouses? And should there be some kind of ongoing payment each month? What's hard to determine is, with especially these days, we're not sure who's going to be, if there are children, who's going to be the stay-at-home spouse? And what if a spouse has, you know, he or she has some of their talents getting a little rusty because they've been staying home with the kids? Those are things that affect it. And yet you really can't provide how much will be there for child support, as Dave and I have noted, for the future if the marriage splits up.
Okay, thanks. Why don't we take a break, Andrew, and come back and pick it up. We have many more bullet points, and we'll listen to what the sponsor of the show, WEPA, can do for the listeners.
You've heard about the wage gap, but do you know about the coverage gap? Studies show that only 47% of women have life insurance, compared to 58% of men. Plus, women carry less coverage on average. female civilian federal employees, do you need life insurance? Visit WAEPA.org today. WAEPA's online tools can show you how much coverage to consider. WAEPA, offering group term life insurance for feds by feds. Visit WAEPA.org today for more.
WAEPA, for feds by feds.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. That the timing of that spot could not have been better. WAEPA has been a terrific sponsor of the show for many years. But it just I didn't even think of it until it started after listening to the two attorneys talk. So it's pretty tough to challenge a prenuptial, and
it really is. Bob, there's three ways in which one might raise a challenge, or three major ways, but generally they're unsuccessful. One of them, I think Steve mentioned before the break, that if you fail to do full disclosure of assets, liabilities, and income, you're vulnerable to a challenge, especially if it turns out that you had more than what you said you had. Number two would be if there was incompetency on the part of an individual, such as a legal disability at the time. And third, and that's the one that might come up the most, would be if they felt undue pressure. And again, the longer you wait to sign it prior to the date of the marriage, the better that argument is. I suppose a fourth would be inadequate representation. The person who prepared it was a piranha, and the attorney who reviewed it was a corporate attorney, had never prepared or even looked at one before, and glossed over it. Whoa. But in general, very, very difficult to challenge.
And let me go back to something in this. Remember that, and I know we have a large federal audience here, that these are mostly creations of state law. I believe nearly every state permits these, but they're very different in each state. So one question is, for example, if you've decided that the couple is getting married in the District of Columbia, well, we'll often state that law continues to control. What if they go out to California or Texas or Arizona, where there's community property? You want to try to control how the terms are and what will control, even if they move. But also remember that when we're talking about, I've had several clients that have said, why do I need to disclose that my parents are wealthy and might leave large trusts for me? Again, the courts want to say, to prepare for Dave's concern that he mentioned, is that, again, we don't want surprises. If one of the spouses said, oh my God, I never would have signed this agreement if I'd known your family were, you know, the Rockefellers or something, well, then we want to avoid that. And it's usually a one or two page summary. It's not like saying I'm showing which stocks, bonds, but it's got to at least be something to have a knowing decision whether it can be, one should sign this or not. And to say that they were represented by an attorney is very helpful to avoid a successful challenge.
Okay, so we're going back between Dave and anyway, so I'm looking at the bullet points, and we're down to what are the estate and gift tax advantages of being married? And it's got Dave's name.
Bob, can I interrupt you for 1 minute?
You certainly can.
I think I neglected to mention a common question is people said, that comes up is there most, and I believe most states, and while they're not quite as strong, there is such a thing as a postnuptial agreement. So let's say that each party to the marriage has two children, I don't know, and that remember that if we got simple wills and one of the spouses saying, well, wait a minute, what happens if I die? I'm a little concerned that the surviving spouse will leave everything to their children and nothing to my children. While that is certainly not the exclusive concern, it is one of them that can be addressed in a postnuptial agreement. And while there's not as much consideration in other legal provisions that give it quite the strength, it often is addressed. Prenuptials seem to be a little bit stronger, but just the fact that a couple has been married 20 years doesn't mean they can't enter into some kind of postnuptial agreement as well.
Steve, I'm dealing with that right now. A couple that has been married, about 35 years, and they each have children by a prior marriage, and they want to leave their respective estates, which are considerable in both cases, to their own children. And I asked, do you have a prenuptial agreement? And they said, no. And under the law, and in this case, it's the District of Columbia, they must leave 50%. In some jurisdictions, it's only a third, to their spouse, absent a nuptial agreement. So among the things that are being done besides updating their estate plan is having each of them waive their right to inherit 50%. And that's called a statutory forced share, and that can be dealt with in the postnuptial agreement.
Right. And this is crucial, Dave, because it is shocking for a lot of people to understand that this what they call an election against the will or the forced election is if in one situation that Dave and I were alluding to, that if the one of the members of the couple wants to leave everything to the children, let's say the first to die wants to leave everything to the children. The surviving spouse doesn't have to question it, but they have the option through a proactive determination to file something, and depending on the state, which is jurisdiction, which typically is somewhere between a third and a half, they can say, no, I don't want the kids to get everything. I am going to require that I'm going to take this third or half along with everything else I would be receiving, and ignore and elect against the will. That's the nature of it. And nearly every state has that. But that's to protect a spouse, whether it's under a theory of spousal protection, the marriage is a partnership. But that is something that typically a prenuptial agreement essentially avoids going to court later on. You can determine ahead saying, well, I'll promise to leave you 15% of my estate no matter what, or 20% or whatever. And the will can always leave more. It just can't leave less than the minimum floor that's set forth in the agreement.
So I'm sitting back listening to each of you speak eloquently, and you make sense. So then it dawned on me, what about people that maybe the marriage isn't bad, but it's also not happy? Does somebody start to think, what should I do to try to build some security given the unknown position of the marriage?
Well, I think there's always a question. So titling is usually important in this agreement. And a marriage itself, Bob, there's always a matter of traditionally, you know, every couple tends to own most things jointly, or what's called tenants by the entirety. But if there's a little bit of insecurity, oftentimes people should consider having some assets in their own name. We're a little concerned because when we represent a couple, we have to give advice to both and not one against the other. But title is a big deal with these agreements, and frankly, in a marriage generally.
So in dealing with clients and the eventual, you have one side, the other has the other side. Do you find that more often than not, there's a reasonable conclusion to the discussions, or what percent goes into battle?
On the prenuptial agreement or on the divorce, Bob?
Let's do the prenuptial first, because that it seems to me that's the
on
one.
On the prenuptial agreement, they normally reach a meeting of the minds that's acceptable to them because they want to get married. On the divorce, it's much rarer that there is a meeting of the minds. Although for smaller estates, there really should be. If there's not a lot to divide, you don't need each party getting a third and the lawyers getting the final third. They do need to come to an agreement expeditiously that's fair. On larger estates, of course, there is more to fight over. And generally the parties do. It is quite difficult to come to a resolution where there is not a nuptial agreement in the larger estates. The party that had the greater income feels he or she should have the greater entitlement, and the party who stayed at home and raise the children feels that the other spouse did nothing around the house and they are entitled to be compensated for it.
Wow.
So Bob, you mentioned, are there issues like the list would cover the old encyclopedia, but there are often matters, even in a general happy long-term marriage, that come up as part of an estate plan. They may disagree about who should be guardians of the kids, who should be the trustees, where the assets would go. Any couple, whether this is prenup or not, should give some thought to a lot of these things even before they deal with their estate plans, such as, you know, if the event they're both disabled, who would be the power of attorney, which is often called either an agent or attorney in fact. Who is the executor? Where should they leave the assets? If it's a second marriage, do they want a postnuptial agreement or do they not? Are they just going to trust the survivor to do right by the first to die? There are a lot of intense things. I'm sure Dave has had this too, but I've had two situations where one of the spouses got up in an estate planning meeting and went to the bathroom, and the other spouse said, okay, these are the changes you're going to put in mine. And I said, no. The weird thing is it happened twice in one day. And I said, we can no longer represent either of you. And it was a little tricky saying why we had to withdraw from our representation. But those things do happen sometimes, and we have to represent each equally, unless there's like one of these prenuptial that it's clear we're on one side or the other.
Okay, one kind of final on the other side. What are the non-tax estate and asset protection benefits of being married?
Okay, let me start out with that, because I think Dave and I both do a lot of asset protection matters and some tax planning and all that. One thing that is often beneficial from being married is there are generally three kinds of tenancies: joint tenancy, tenants by the entirety, and tenants in common. The joint tenants is more or less similar to what's community property in one of the 11 jurisdictions out west that have that. But tenants by the entirety, so Bob, if you and I own a joint bank account that's $10,000, I die, it's yours. Doesn't matter what my will says or anything else. If there is a tenancy by the entirety in most jurisdictions, not everyone, I believe such as Colorado don't have tenants by the entirety, but the two differences are it's a form of a joint tenancy, but it must be between spouses. And if one of the members of the couple punches somebody or there's a lawsuit, with certain exceptions such as super creditors like the SEC or IRS, then generally they cannot reach the underlying asset unless they are a creditor of both. So, for example, if both spouses punch the person, well, yes, they could probably reach the underlying house. But it is one advantage, and it is a little protection. There's some legal matters of each state, like, you know, being able to, you know, have visitation rights in hospitals and all that.
I'm busily writing down things, and I thought people listening might want to write down your phone number and or website.
Well, phone number is 301-340-2020, and our website is www.steinwithat.com.
Very good. Pension plans, profit sharing plans, you know, our audience is not all feds. But they do have retirement plans, and they don't have profit sharing plans per se because because it's a federal agency. But they do have IRAs, and I would say it's not uncommon for one spouse to be a Fed and the other one to be a non-Fed. So have you faced situations like that where the one might not understand, say, the thrift savings plan? Or they might not understand the years in service and highest compensation. Have you met that challenge?
Well, actually, pretty often. So let me start with a couple basic rules that people should know. And there's this one weird law that whether it's a plan under the federal system, the TSP through the savings plan, that if there is going to be a divorce, then one way to avoid accelerating the income taxes is to get this option, which a portion of the plan would be moved over to essentially the non-working spouse through what's called a quadro, a qualified domestic relations order, which really has the benefit of avoiding the acceleration of taxes, but at the same time can reallocate a portion of the future annuity and or the defined plan, the TSP, to the non-working spouse. That is called the Retirement Equity Act that came in the mid-80s. The consent of the spouse also on a future disposition is required unless it's an IRA. And then it's a little bit, there are not the restrictions of a spouse who is the participant to leave it to who or she, he or she wants. Dave, do you want to jump in on that more?
I think that you have pretty much covered it. It does require a lot of creativity dealing with retirement plans in the case of a divorce. And sometimes the best solution, and this would apply to what I call non-qualified deferred compensation as well, such as stock options or restricted stock units, is an if, as, and when, so that the non-titled spouse will get an entitlement when the titled spouse comes into the funds from the qualified or non-qualified retirement plan. It is a, there's a lot of tough issues associated with it. And because retirement plans of all types and deferred compensation is being emphasized in the private sector and certainly in the government in terms of the various governmental plans, it really requires knowledge and creativity.
So, and I want to add two more pieces because the focus of our program today is on divorce, prenups. When there's a divorce, I think there are a couple misconceptions that I often think that if there's going to be a divorce, well, maybe even for a regular estate plan too, the party should really look at sort of the buckets of assets, whether it's going to be IRAs, what are the retirement plan assets, what's the life insurance, what is the house worth. And I'm surprised how many people assume that, well, we agreed on our wills, or we have a revocable trust to minimize probate, and this is where it goes. And then we'll often say, but have you divided up in some form or allocated your retirement plans, your, you know, annuities, your TSP out will pass on the surviving spouse's death? And they'll say, well, we took care of that through our wills and that's it. No, life insurance and retirement plans, especially TSPs and IRAs, have to be taken care of through beneficiary designation. Both the primary and contingent beneficiaries. And that is something that on the divorce, not only should they determine where it goes, but once the divorce has occurred, they should make sure they change their beneficiary designations, because it happens all the time that they've still got their spouse still named. And that is not a pretty picture when the family's, you know, when the death occurs.
As I listen to each of you talk, I'm thinking the federal employee that's listening to this that is married to a non-Fed, are there certain things that they can do without trying to be slick or hide it from the other? Are certain things that they can do to protect their assets as a federal employee versus the non?
So I think what's a little tricky, and I'm pretty sure this would work the same way, whether, let's assume somebody's got an annuity and they have a thrift savings plan. Going back to the mid-80s when the Retirement Equity Act, and I'm showing my age, but this was when Gene Ferraro was trying to protect, you know, people with running off and buying trailers in Florida or something. But the theory is, I think without the spouse consenting to it, or just saying, I'm going to change my beneficiary to the cabana boy or just the kids, it's hard to do without the spouse's consent. Because remember the general rule that for a qualified plan of some sort, other than IRAs, you can't really name somebody on retirement, death, or disability that is does not include the spouse. Once they're divorced, the rules are very different. The spouse normally would need to consent to it while they're married.
So in the planning phase, is there any tax difference between alimony and child support? I can imagine alimony is tax deductible, and maybe not 100% of it, but it's going to be some tax deductible, and child support. So
let me address that preliminarily, and then I know Dave has had so much experience with this and had to deal with a lot of court cases too. The general rule right now is that both the payment of alimony and child support, and there's been a lot of changes, beginning in 2019, but generally the payment of alimony and child support, both those are not deductible. Most people assume the payment of alimony is deductible to the wealthy spouse, and the poor spouse, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, would take it into income. Dave, I believe that it's not only non-deductible, but it's not taxable to the recipient's spouse, correct?
That's correct, Steve. That was a pretty abrupt change in the law, effective for agreements signed in 2019. And beyond, you're still going to see a deduction on the tax return for alimony, because if your divorce or separation instrument was entered into before 2019, then the old law applies, and it is, if all the criteria are met, it's deductible by the payor. and income to the recipient. And that raises a very, very interesting question. Hypothetically, you signed in 1995, let's say, a prenuptial agreement under which you would pay, I'm making a number up, $4,000 per month for 60 months. In the event of divorce at the time, the potential payor contemplated that it would be deductible. The law changed, and then in 2022, you separate and ultimately get divorced. Was the prenuptial agreement a divorce or separation instrument executed before 2019 so that it is deductible to the payor and income to the recipient? A lot of talk about this, both in tax and family law circles. I think old law applies. The majority of people seem to differ with me and thinks it's non-deductible to the payor and not income to the recipient. It is an outstanding question.
Wow. And on a related matter is that I remember both in negotiating prenuptial agreements and agreeing to the terms of a divorce, it was really, this was no small matter, determining whether the alimony payments would be deductible and then taxable to the recipient, because there's sort of that offshoot. It's either, because if it's not, you know, deductible, then it's not income. But that was a big point of negotiation in both the determination of prenuptial agreement terms, as well as the fact in divorces. The good news is that's no longer a big issue because it's essentially set. Because as Dave and I noted, that the alimony and child support are essentially, to some degree, non-tax considerations, but it really impacts, it means the alimony and child support are paid with after-tax dollars. So suddenly, you know, if you got $7,000 or $8,000, if you need a $3,000 or $4,000 payment, it's going to take what, $6,000 or $7,000, whatever it might be, because it's only after tax and there's no deduction. It's a pretty big impact and a big change since prior law.
Jeez. So with individuals, I'm sure one walks out of the courtroom less than happy, and the other one walks out, you know, a little bit more than happy. After that, have you seen situations where the agreement was set, X has to pay Y a certain amount, and then X says, I don't have any money, I lost my job, or the business went down? What happens to the delta between what should have been paid and what is paid?
You know, that remains, of course, a debt of one spouse to the other. It has its own complex tax considerations, but that happens quite frequently. Generally, in most jurisdictions, a alimony award is modifiable, but the parties by agreement can make a alimony payment non-modifiable. But to correct something you said, Bob, most of the time, both parties come out of the courtroom a bit unhappy.
Hmm.
And the eternal thing is, it's, I guess it's like most businesses, you want your owners to be equally unhappy at the end of a meeting. But the catch-22 there is a practical matter, is that if there's a failure to pay alimony or child support, you know, you don't want to be too successful, because if the family law attorney is bringing this guy in, this, assuming it's the guy in for non-payment, In theory, it's a sort of a contempt of court because they're not complying with the agreement. But at the same time, how can the person pay their obligations if they're sitting in jail or they're restricted? So you don't want to be too successful there. You want to figure out what is the, and there's often, you know, the old argument that they've, you know, don't play too well in the sandbox once that divorce has come around, and they don't continue to play well in the sandbox, especially after they don't have to live together.
All righty. Suppose a couple has filed joint estimated tax payments or left a prior year tax refund on the table for current year taxes. Who gets the payment for these, who gets the credit for these payments if they file separately?
That's a really interesting question, Bob, and it's one that I've dealt with for about 30 years off and on. About three decades ago, I handled a situation with a couple that separated after the third of four estimated tax payments was made for the year. The first three payments were with joint vouchers, and the fourth one was separate. I represented the wife who had little or no tax liability, and because the estimated payments on the joint voucher were made with marital money, I had her claim 50% of the estimated payments, which came, as I recall, to just under $200,000. The husband claimed all of those three estimated payments, as well as that fourth that was just in his name. IRS, sometime later, about 21 months later, demanded a return from my client of $200,000. The IRS position is that when a joint voucher is utilized and the parties do not reach an agreement, and the same applies to a joint refund where the following year there will be separate returns. The IRS position is that it is to be divided based on comparative tax liability. Well, that's all well and good, but number one, trying to get the other spouse's tax liability is a real chore. They don't want to give it to you. And number two, that does go against the principles of ownership. And at least one court has disagreed with the IRS position and says that it is based on ownership. In the fact situation that I handled, IRS had 24 months to get back that $200,000 that was claimed by both individuals, and they failed to file suit within their time period. And my client kept it, and her divorcing spouse got to keep it as well. So again, the IRS position, comparative tax liability, at least one court says it's based on ownership.
And there are related ripple effects there to that question, too. We've had several situations where, you know, the couple was probably, you know, married but separated, and one of the spouses died. One question is, well, like Dave said, when you're tracing it or based on tax liability, what do you show for the probate assets? Number two, if there's estate tax obligations, similar, what is essentially the net worth, the value of this person's estate? And if it's based on ownership, tax liability? How do you trace it and make that distinction? So is it, there are a lot of questions that relate to this that it's a tough one to figure out.
Okay, we've got about, what, 3 minutes, Andrew? Final thoughts? I mean, I don't know how many people are trying to take notes. I gave up. What was the takeaway in 3 minutes? I would imagine plan, get good representation, and don't get mad. But that's my non-legal question.
Well, let me start. I think first of all that, and I want to defer to Dave here to also, but I think planning goes into this. It's amazing when people will see take care of their divorce, and they often don't do the follow-up. They don't, clean up their take care of their powers of attorney. They don't change their beneficiary designations. It's still the same old spouse. And you can't imagine how often this occurs. But a little bit of his follow-up, prenuptial agreements, I think some people said that's just for the super rich. No, it's a lot more and more people are doing it, but it's follow-up, it's planning and addressing the needs. And obviously, we're a little biased, but they should talk to an attorney to address these matters.
Okay,
And
60 seconds.
to put an additional perspective on it, your estate plan must be reviewed following a separation, although certain provisions could only apply post-divorce. And for larger estates, keep in mind that the exemption in terms of what you can pass to the next generation is effectively reduced because you had your spouse's exemption that you could tack on to yours, irrespective of who was the first to die, through portability of that exemption in the federal tax system and in some states. I guess the moral of the whole discussion today is that at various life events, you should be planning for the next phase of your life.
Very good. One more time, the phone number, and then we have Andrew's going to cut us off.
301-340-2020 and www.steinsperling.com.
Dave, thank you.
A pleasure.
And where's your cohort?
I'm right here.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being involved, and thanks for including us, Bob.
Well, thanks for
Appreciate it.
coming on. All righty. Group, listen to us next week. You might want to listen to today's show one or two times. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.